Hi, this is Liz Van Doren, and I am executive editor in charge of the book publishing operation at Highlights for Children and Boyd's Mills Press. And today I'm talking to Kate Hosford, who is the author of two picture books, Big Bouffant and Big Birthday, for Amherst Reads.
Thanks, Liz.
So, Kate, when did you know you wanted to be a children's book writer?
Well, that's a good question. I actually started as an illustrator. I went to art school at age 30 with absolutely no drawing skills and was determined to become an illustrator, and worked sort of marginally as an illustrator for a number of years, and decided that in order to get more work, I might try submitting some picture book dummies, where I was doing both the writing and the illustrating. I quickly learned that I was actually much better at the writing than I was at the art, and was actually very happy to leave the art behind. Like, once I realized that I could express myself better as a writer, it became clear I just needed to have a creative outlet, and it didn't really matter which one it was. And now I'm very happy to actually have illustrators who can, I would say, more completely fulfill my vision than I would be able to. Because I started art quite late, I was a little bit technically hampered. And with the writing, I don't feel that at all. I feel I can really sort of just let my imagination go, and that I have the vision skills that I need, and it's just a much more pleasurable process.
You know, a lot of children's book writers have a difficult time with having someone else bring their story visually to life, and particularly people who are artists themselves, mm-hmm. who sometimes think visually when they're writing their books. They struggle when they see someone else bringing a level of creativity and vision to their stories. Did you struggle with that at all, or did you enjoy that process?
Both. I did struggle with it initially. There were little teeny things that bugged me in the illustrations that now I don't mind at all. So it was a bit of an adjustment process. And now I look at the art and I'm very happy with it. And I sort of think, well, why was I up nights about the fact that, you know, Annabelle's dress is not the way I thought it would be or something? You know, now I that doesn't matter to me at all. But I think it's hard for everyone. And I was very lucky. Learner let me really be in on the whole process. So I got to see all the sketches. I got to see the initial artwork. I got to be part of the revision process with the artwork. And I think that's fairly unusual. I mean, I think there are writers where they sort of see the sketches and then they see the finished artwork and they don't really see much in between. So I'm very grateful to them for letting me be in on that. I'm doing a third book called Infinity and Me that will come out in the fall, where the illustrator is a very dear friend of mine. And that was an interesting process too, because, you know, you have your professional relationship, you have your friendship, and it was a balancing act, but we're better friends than ever. And in that case, we had submitted a book dummy together, so I sort of knew from the outset what the sketches would look like. But, you know, the process of going from sketches to finished artwork, things can change completely, because it's not clear to the illustrator after the sketches are done what the finished artwork will look like, or they change their mind about what they want to do, or all sorts of things. So I think it's important not to get too attached to the sketches.
So backing up a little bit, and we'll come back to this topic,
sure.
Both of these books, Big Birthday and Big Bouffant, are about a very self-confident and independent character named Annabelle. And I'm wondering, where did this character come from? Were you looking to create a role model for girls? Were you looking to write books that had a message underneath the story? What were you thinking about when you created Annabelle?
I think for a lot of writers, this stuff kind of emerges subconsciously. I mean, I didn't really set out to do much of anything except for write a story about a girl who wants a bouffant. I mean, it really started with the word bouffant. I thought bouffant was a funny word, and my boys at home, when their hair was sort of big and unkempt, would say to each other, you know, you have a bouffant. No, you have a bouffant. You know, they're little. And then for 5 years, I tried to write this story in prose, actually, and I knew there was an idea there, but it was pretty boring. I couldn't make the story come together. It was too long, and everyone said, whatever you do, don't try it in rhyme, because that's the kiss of death. And so I said, okay, you know, I won't. And then finally I did, and it was at that point that it became a story. And I thought, you know, why? Of course, everything is clear in retrospect, but I sort of felt, why didn't I just try it in rhyme from the beginning? So I think the impulsivity in the character comes a little bit from who I am. And I think it's always been important to me to just be able to help other people sort of realize their creative visions and help myself realize my creative vision. So Annabelle in the story has something that she wants to do. She pursues that goal. She can't achieve it on her own. She then asks her mother for help. She's then teased at school. You know, there are all these roadblocks along the way, but in the end, she's able to fulfill her own vision of creativity and individuality. And that, I think, is what is important to me and what I want to impart to kids. That, you know, your true self may not always be something that people accept immediately, but if you, you know, stick to your guns and go forward with your vision and are strong about it, in the end, people usually respect that.
Another thing that I found interesting about these two books is that they're both about classic childhood experiences. One of them is starting school, and one of them is a birthday party gone awry. And I think that some of the best and most lasting books for children are books that focus on those universal experiences but bring a unique twist. So with a back-to-school book, you might expect that the child in the story is scared of going to school. And yet you have turned both of those experiences away from what the reader's expectations might be to give them a unique twist. So what was your development process with the story like as you turned these classic experiences kind of on their heads, so to speak?
Again, I would like to say that it was intentional, but I think that might be giving myself too much credit. The bouffant story started out with a girl who admired her librarian at school who had a bouffant, and she had an uncle who ran a hair salon, and, you know, it was all over the place. And just eventually I sort of homed in on the story. But with Big Birthday, I had a different protagonist. I think I had a whole different story called something like Lucinda's Best Birthday Party Ever, I think is what I called it. And it was about this girl who actually hated gravity and really wanted to have her birthday on the moon. But a lot of it really focused on hating gravity. That was my big thing. And, you know, editors said, well, that's, kids just aren't really going to understand that. But then eventually I realized that Lucinda was sort of the same person as Annabelle. They were both these girls who had really strong creative vision and were trying to go after what they wanted, no matter how badly they failed in the process. So I actually didn't really think that much about the fact that they had to... With the birthday party, I thought about it a little more. I wanted it to be a huge birthday party meltdown, and I thought, well, what could be bigger than a meltdown on the moon? And then I also wanted the message to be that, well, maybe a birthday party in your backyard is more fun than a birthday party on the moon. I mean, maybe where you can go with your imagination ultimately is better than everything you have to go through to have a birthday on the moon.
You mentioned editors as you were answering that question, and I think one of the things about publishing children's books that is unique in almost the creation of any end product, and I hate to call a book a product, but in this case it applies, is that the consumer and the user of your book are two different entities.
Yes.
Because when you publish children's books, you have to get through layers and layers and layers of adults. The editor, the salespeople, the buyer at the big bookstore chain, or the librarian. And finally, after the book makes it through all of those gatekeepers, it gets into the hands of children. So sometimes it's you come across challenges in that process because people are thinking about the next adult in line rather than the child in the end. How did you keep your focus on children as you were navigating the process of writing and trying to get this book published?
Well, I have a couple of children, so that helps. I was reading lots of picture books at home. I was also in the process of getting my MFA at Vermont College, but we didn't actually spend a lot of time at Vermont College talking about children per se. I think really what it amounted to in most cases was just tuning into your inner child. And if you can do that effectively, I mean, I think there are probably amazing children's book authors out there who may not even like children, who still actually are very good because they can tune into their inner child. And if they can do it effectively, then they can write a good children's book.
So this may be an impossible question to answer, but for anyone who might be thinking about wanting to write children's books, how do you tune into your inner child? What do you do in your writing process that makes you access or helps you to access that?
Well, the joke we had in my MFA program is that every writer's development is arrested at a different level, and your level of arrested development corresponds to what you write. So I guess as a picture book author, my development arrested pretty early, you know,
maybe
at six or seven.
Yeah.
And I don't know if I do anything in particular. It just sort of seems to come out. Like, I know I'm attracted to writing for kids at that age. I mostly write about girls. Some people have said perhaps this is because I have two boys. I don't know. I don't really think it's about that. I think it's just that I am a girl. And I'm not sure exactly what I do to tune into that inner girl, except I do know that after I wrote these books, I realized afterwards, oh, this is me, like that. But I did not realize it while I was writing the books. I mean, I was the child who at age four would run into the bathroom, take everything I could get my hands on, and make a huge soup in the sink. Or, you know, as a 30-year-old, I was like the bride-to-be who 2 weeks before my wedding decided it would be a really cool thing to make my husband a quilt, although I didn't know how to sew. You know, so in some ways I feel I have vision, but I'm not that practical. And I guess that sort of, you see that a bit in Annabelle.
So how, as a wife and a mother, do you work writing into your day?
Well, it's interesting that you ask that, because when I did my MFA program, which was a ton of work, I mean, over a minimum of 20 hours a week, I seem to make it work. Now that that program has been done for a year, I'm finding it harder and harder to carve out my writing time. And I realize part of it is that I work really well when I have these external sort of deadlines. And when I don't have those, you know, I'll sort of say, well, I can either pick the kids up at 3 or I can write for 2 more hours, you know. And if you don't watch it, your time just fritters away. So I am in the process of reclaiming my writing time. And you really have to do these silly things, like open your planner and say, okay, from 9 until 5, I don't do anything else, and write it there and make it official. And, you know, you're not going to have coffee with a friend, and you're not going to go to the doctor, and you're not going to do anything, because you need at least an hour just to become centered enough to even begin to write. Sometimes I'll write at night. I know a lot of people get up at 5 in the morning and try to write. That hasn't really worked for me. I can't. I just don't have the energy. And the other thing is that your books, in a strange way, can actually pull you away from your writing, because promoting a book is so much work that you then become this promotion machine. And, you know, I know that's part of my job, but it is not writing. So
talk a little bit about that, because there are a lot of mysteries involved in publishing a book. There's the mystery of the creative process, and then there's, and I'll come back to the editorial process, there's the mystery of the editorial process, but there's also the mystery of what is the author supposed to do once the publisher takes their book away from them, manufactures it, and starts to sell it.
Right.
How do you support your publisher, and what is it that you're doing to help support your books?
Well, Lerner was great to me and continues to be great to me. They made Big Bouffant the lead book on their list, which as a first-time author was, you know, really thrilling. It was on the cover of the catalog, and I just went crazy with the publicity. I ended up doing a book tour out in California, which I financed privately. They did a lot of things for me, but that I did on my own. You know, suddenly I was in front of these huge audiences at schools, and sometimes not such big audiences at bookstores. You know, I decided to have a huge launch party at Books of Wonder, and, you know, it turned out I was actually pretty good at the promotion part of it. But this time around, I'm realizing I can't do what I did for that book for every book, because it's just, you know, the expenditure is too great. And also, I can't have every family vacation turned into a book tour, which is what happened with Big Bouffant. And, you know, it is not fun for your children to come to your book events. I mean, they were sort of casting about in San Jose as I went and did these events. But I think promotion is a major, major part of what an author does, and I'm just continuing to look for kind of new and efficient ways to promote myself. I tend to like to be in front of an actual audience. I'm not a huge social media person. I'm trying to become a bigger one, but, you know, I don't like to be on Twitter constantly or...
Well, that can provide a big distraction. Twitter and Facebook and all of the other social media outlets can provide a huge distraction from your writing, which I've heard
Absolutely.
A lot of writers complain about, that they spend all their time tweeting as a means to avoiding the writing that is not going well, or because they're so excited that the book that they just published is out that they're not really focusing on what their core job is, which is writing the next one.
I'll tell you, the one thing I've learned how to do, and I've had some success with it, is I go individually into each Barnes & Noble and say, hi, I'm an author. I know you carry my book. in your you know, that you have my book, but I don't know if it's in your store. And if it's not, I ask them if they would order it. I just ask. And
do you ask them if they want you to sign books?
I do.
That's a good trick for them not returning it.
Back, right? I do that. And then if they don't have it, I just say, well, would you consider ordering it? It's face out at Barnes & Noble in Union Square. I see that it's not here. You know, is that something you would consider? And, you know, sometimes they say, well, that's not up to us. That's up to the corporate office, blah, blah, blah. But sometimes they just say, sure, and they do it. And once I figured that out, just made a point of going around and doing it and making friends with these people and, you know, becoming friends with the manager of Books of Wonder and just taking advantage of the fact that I'm in New York and, you know, I should do what I can here.
You know, it's interesting because writers have very distinct personalities from one to the next, and writing is such a solitary undertaking, right. And promoting your book is such a public undertaking, and a lot of people aren't like you. They don't take pleasure in the speaking to audiences. They don't take pleasure in the sitting in a bookstore hoping that someone will come to their signing, and in conversing with librarians and teachers and booksellers and all of the people who are the champions of children's books in the marketplace. So I love hearing you say that you enjoy that, because I'm sure your publisher appreciates all of the energy that you put into this.
They really do. And with Big Blue Font, I somehow figured out that if you put a plastic bottle on the top of a child's head and swoop their hair over it and take ribbons and wrap them around kind of the way you'd wrap ribbons for a toe shoe, you can make this crazy looking bouffant. And so I went around the country basically and had these events that were hair parties. You know, I did like 12 hair parties. After 12, I was done. I mean, I'm not up for another hair party right away. But my book just lent itself to that kind of promotion. And then for this book, I just had the launch party a few days ago. Luckily, my dad is a former architect, and he made these amazing foam core rocket ships. And then all the kids decorated the rocket ships. So, you know, I don't know if he'll do that for me again. But, you know, I do try to think of a hook. I mean, otherwise, you get to these events, and if you have a picture book, your event is done in 5 minutes. I mean, you read the book, and then what are you going to do? So you have to have something, because kids aren't going to sit there for a long Q&A about being an author necessarily. In school, more so, but on the weekend at a bookstore, not as much.
What kind of questions do kids ask you when you go into schools? A lot of authors say that the first question kids ask is, how much money do you make? Which most authors have a very deft way of deflecting.
Right.
But do they ask you about your characters, or do they ask about the creative process, or is it hard to get them to focus?
No, they ask about all of those things, and then they sometimes make the most hilarious comments. I was trying to explain how it took me 5 years to figure out how to do Big Blue Font in rhyme, and this little kindergartner looked at me and she said, don't feel badly. It was just your first book. Next time it won't take so long.
It's very sweet that she felt the need to reassure you.
She felt, and then, of course, there's always like the jaded kind of Park Slope kid who raises their hand and says, like, was it really, really difficult for you to get your agent?
Well, let's talk about that. So you wrote this book.
Yes.
And you had completed the manuscript and you decided not to publish it. And then did you find yourself an agent, or did you submit directly to publishers?
Well, I had submitted a lot of other things directly to publishers. And I had the emails of a few editors from my friend Gabby Swiakowska, who was an illustrator. And I actually was very lucky to have editors who actually would write me back. And I had correspondences going with a few of them. And this went on for years. And they were lovely and very nice. And a few things came close to being published. But ultimately, nothing ever was. So I then went to a Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators weekend conference. and met an editor who liked Big Blue Font, not an editor, an agent, and worked on it with me, and then she sold it pretty quickly to Lerner. So I would like to say that you can do this without an agent, but and occasionally people do, but it's very hard because most publishing houses are closed to unsolicited submissions, even if they're open to them. What I always picture, and I don't know if this is true, is like an intern just sitting there opening things up, going through a huge stack of submissions. You know, an agent just gives you a different kind of entree to editors.
Well, I can tell you from the inside what ends up happening is that the reason publishers say no unsolicited submissions is not because we don't want to encourage new talent, but because we simply don't have the staff to weather the wealth of people who think they can write a children's book. And writing children's books is a very interesting process because I pretty much have never met anyone who doesn't want to write a children's book.
Exactly.
And I have met few people who think they can't. And it's much harder. It is much, much harder than it looks to create a cohesive, meaningful, emotionally resonant, memorable story in less than 1,000 words is a monumental task. And I think that success in writing and publishing children's books is one of the most admirable things that I can think of course, because I'm in this field. But I think that it's true that it takes a tremendous amount of time and effort and requires the support of professionals who can create. I mean, networking is the best thing you can do.
Yeah.
Finding an agent is incredibly important. I think people sometimes are scared that publishers won't like them if they have an agent.
Mm.
But in fact, it's quite the opposite.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. But finding, you know, it's a catch-22 because finding an agent is almost as hard as selling a manuscript. And, you know, sometimes it's hard to get an agent if you haven't sold anything, but it's hard to sell anything if you don't have an agent. So, you know, I consider myself lucky that I was able to, you know, find someone who would take me on.
What was the revision process like once you had sold, or your agent had sold your book to an editor? And how did you establish a productive and mutually trusting relationship with that editor? Or how did he or she establish it with you?
Well, I have an amazing editor named Anna Cavallo. And there is so much, you have to have so much trust there. And I got so lucky with her, because in my opinion, we sort of did this book together. I mean, you know, I would be happy if her name were on the front as well. I feel like, you know, you hear people talk about self-publishing and why do you need editors anyway, and what do they do and for you that's so great? Well, people just don't understand. Everybody needs an editor. I don't care how brilliant you are. You can't view your own work objectively, and you have to have someone else there who can do that with you. So in Big Blue Font, we worked a lot on the rhyme. I became sort of obsessive about just making sure that the rhyme worked. And we also made sure we put enough obstacles in the path of the main characters so that it would be a story where kids continue to be excited and there's a fair amount of growth over the arc of the story. But there wasn't as much revision on that project as there was on Big Birthday.
So what is there anything that you studied in college that sort of helped guide you towards children's books or informed your desire to publish children's books, or did that come much later?
Well, I did have a roommate in college who is now a professor of comparative literature. She was brilliant, and she loved picture books and would spend a lot of time reading picture books in college. And I remember thinking, oh, that's sort of interesting. And she was a poet, and I decided I was also going to become a poet. Again, with no real background in poetry, I just said, well, I'm going to do this. So I I spent a week writing a few poems. I sent them off to this professor at Smith. That's where the poetry writing seminar was being held. And, you know, he kindly informed me that really I wasn't ready for this sort of seminar, at which point I think I burst into tears, and he took me on. So, so I had the interest in poetry from early on, and I loved children's books as a kid, but it never occurred to me to do something like this in college because it just didn't seem economically feasible. So I wouldn't even allow myself to have that dream.
And how did you end up at Vermont College? What led you to that program?
My father used to run something. I grew up in Vermont, and my father used to run something called Project Harmony, which is an exchange program of former Soviet Union countries and different groups from the United States. So we always have these groups coming through our house. You know, it'll be 30 Armenians for dinner one day, you know, the 10 jugglers from Kazakhstan the next day. And so I was home a couple summers ago, and it was the 30 Armenians for dinner night. And to tell you the truth, I was kind of grumpy about it. I thought, ugh, I just want to hang out with my family. Like, I don't know if this group of people can speak English. But then it turned out that one of the other Project Harmony people who was working with this group was married to this woman who'd gone to Vermont College, and she started talking to me about the program. And, I thought, ooh, this really sounds good. But I knew it involved a lot of critical writing as well, and I wasn't sure I really wanted to do that. It sounded too much like going back to college. But the more I thought about it, I thought, you know, I can do it. I'm going to apply. And it was the best decision I ever made.
It's a really rigorous program, and it's also a program for highly motivated students because it's a non-residency program.
Yes.
So you don't have the opportunity to get inspiration from other people's work habits. So again, it's interesting that you chose a very solitary pursuit toward your MFA. But I'm hearing, as you're speaking, I'm hearing a lot of, coming from you, a lot of the qualities that you invested in your character, some of those sort of maverick approaches to challenges and taking not necessarily the most direct or expected path, which is kind of interesting.
Thank you.
So you were talking about, you talked about how you loved children's books. What are some of your favorite children's books?
Well,
that you either remember or that you have discovered?
Yes. Well, I was definitely a typical kind of girl in the 70s, reading a lot of Judy Blume, Laura Ingalls Wilder. I was always really drawn to books about New York City. I loved Harriet the Spy and The Mixed Up Files of Mrs. Basilie Frankweiler. Did nothing but read until I was 12, at which point I discovered gymnastics and the reading sort of fell off a little bit. In terms of picture books, I just read everything under the sun. I mean, to this day, I still look at Dr. Seuss and Shel Silverstein and think that they were so far ahead of their time then, and they still are now. Like, those books are so cutting edge, and such, their vision is so unique. Shel Silverstein especially, I spend a lot of time reading, I think because I'm drawn to poetry. And I loved this book growing up called Alexander and the Magic Mouse, which has gone out of print, but it's this amazing book by Martha Sanders, and I wish I'd brought it with me, actually, and the illustrator is named Philippe Fix. And this gorgeous, quirky story of four animals who live together. There's a Tibetan yak, a brindle London squatting cat, the mouse, the alligator, and they live with an old lady in a Victorian mansion at the top of a mountain. But one thing that, I was just rereading it last night actually, and one thing that really struck me is one of the wonderful things about this book is that it's quite long, and it's really hard to do a picture book these days that's, you know, much over 1,000 words. And I was looking at it and saying, what would this book have been like if the editor had said, okay, we have to really pare this down, like, you know, I don't know how you're going to do it, author, but you got to get rid of a lot of this text. And I do sometimes feel nostalgic for some of those picture books that were just a little longer.
Does your experience of being a mother and reading to your sons kind of support that, or change that at all? I think a lot of people in children's publishing talk about whether you need to be a parent in order to really,
right,
really understand children's books. And I know I was a children's book editor before I had a child,
right,
and my perspective on children publishing books definitely changed,
right,
after I had a child. But I wonder if that love for longer books, for example, remains true when you're trying to get your kids into bed and they're picking the stories that they want you to read.
You know, I hear that a lot from editors, and I mean, I suppose there's some, I mean, parents are tired, but presumably they always were. I don't know if they're any more tired now than they ever were. And for my husband, the books that he loved as a child were the Bill Peet picture books, and those are long. And, you know, I mean, I think the kid a little bit takes their cue from the parent, frankly, and if the parent is up for reading the longer picture book, the child will do it. So then the question is, I guess, are parents up for the longer picture book, and if not, why not? Did that answer your question?
It did. Yeah. It did. I mean, it's always a conundrum from the perspective of the editor and the publisher, because we can only sell what we can sell.
Right.
And there are all those gatekeepers that I mentioned before between us and
yeah,
children. So
right,
it's always been a circular conversation, and I think it always will
right
be in this field, because
right
we are creating something for kids
right
that is bought by adults.
Right. And I firmly believe that, you know, the minute you start reading chapter books is not the minute you stop reading picture books. And that in many ways, picture books can be even more complex than chapter books, because you have the interplay of text and illustrations, and that really we should all be encouraging children to continue with those books as long as possible. I mean, I actually believe that a lot of adults read picture books, you know, adults who aren't parents, and I wish that happened even more.
I think it would be great if it did.
Yeah.
So one of the theories that I bring to editing a picture book is that the sum of the two parts, the text and the art, is greater
mm-hmm
than the whole.
Yes.
And that somehow the marriage of text and art should create a whole that is bigger than either of the creators envisioned. And I'm curious what you think the illustrator of your books, Holly Clifton Brown, brought to the stories that made them even bigger than you imagined they would be, if anything.
Holly has such a strong whimsicality and style that, you know, Annabelle is obviously a very whimsical girl, and, you know, you can hear that in the story, but to see it in the pictures is a whole other thing. And for instance, in Big Birthday, at one point she makes her own rocket ship, and Holly created this incredible rocket ship out of cardboard boxes and duct tape, and it's painted three shades of purple. You know, because many kids start having picture books read to them, everybody starts having picture books read to them before they can read. They are so tuned in on these details. And to me, these illustrations are ones that you want to look at more than once, because there are lots of little details. In fact, the child pointed something out to me in Big Birthday the other day that I had never noticed. She said, look, at the end, when she has her pirate party the next year, she's taken a dress from the last birthday party, and she's cut it up, and they've made a little flag outside. I said, oh my gosh, you're right. I hadn't noticed that. But, you know, there's this whole sort of, I don't want to call it a subplot because it's just as important, but it's like in music when you have like the melody and the counterpoint, there's this whole other thing going on. And I've got to say, the illustrations really can make or break a book, and I lucked out with Holly.
You did. Her artwork is just as whimsical as your text is. But I think those subplots are very important. You know, everyone who ever had the book Goodnight Moon read to them as a child remembers just looking for the mouse from page to page and finding out where he has moved throughout the room. And I think that because, as you said, children's books, the child being read to is probably not a reader yet. And so really all they have to look at is the page. And to them, the page is a world.
Right.
And these books are a very beautiful collaboration between your text and the vision of this illustrator.
Thank you. Yeah, it's interesting when you read to very small children, up to a certain age, you can just see, like, when you start reading the book, their faces kind of relax in a certain way, and you can tell they're in that world, and for them it is completely real. As kids get, you know, when they're maybe 9 or 10, you can still enjoy a picture book, but you sort of understand that it's a book. But when they're little, it is real. Sometimes it's interesting to go. I've gone in and read these books with kindergartners and with third graders and with all sorts of different ages, and just to see the different ways they react is very interesting.
Do your sons like reading your stories? And do you use them as sort of a sounding board for your stories?
One son, the little one, yes, is pretty involved in the process. The older one, I think, is just concerned that I not do anything to embarrass him.
I think probably all children would say that about their parents, writers or not.
Last week I had the launch party back to back with a visit where I went and did poetry in my child's class, and he said, we're just getting all the embarrassing stuff over with at once. It'll be over with in 48 hours, right, Mom? I said, yes.
So are you going to, or are you planning more books that star Annabelle?
There's nothing slated yet. But I do have this book, Infinity in Me, coming out in the fall, and I'm really excited about that. That also has a protagonist who's a little girl. Her name is Uma. And it's a book about a little girl who is trying to figure out what infinity means. And at the same time, she is hoping that someone will notice her very pretty red shoes. So you have sort of a very big concept going on, and then she has this very sort of small worry, except it's not small to her. And it's in the first person, which is, you know, slightly unusual for a picture book, and I'll just be very interested to see what sort of reception it gets. The illustrations are gorgeous. My friend Gabby Swiatkowska is just a beautiful illustrator, and so we'll see. And I'm one of the reasons I'm so excited about it is that I think anyone I've talked to about this project has said, oh yeah, my child was really interested in infinity. You know, they started talking about it when they were about 4. And, you know, there's this whole sort of belief that kids can't necessarily grasp anything abstract at a young age, when in reality, kids are thinking about death and infinity and all sorts of things at a very young age. I'm hoping actually to start some sort of blog or, you know, portion of my website that can be devoted to kids who want to, you know, talk about infinity and say, you know, what it means to them. I mean, the things kids have said to me so far are just mind-blowing.
You know, I think one of the greatest crimes that someone attempting to write children's books can commit is to try to write down to children, to simplify their language or dumb down the ideas in their book because they think that children won't understand them. And I think you, through talking to you, you've talked about some really big ideas: gravity, infinity, very sophisticated language, words like bouffant that children may not know what it means, but it certainly rolls off the tongue in a really pleasing way. And I think those are qualities that are inherent in the kind of memorable, affecting books for kids that really make them excited because the ideas are bigger than they are.
Right, and they feel like they're learning something. Yeah, I think you're right. You know, there's this amazing Norwegian picture book that came out, I don't know, a couple of years ago called Garmin Summer. And it's this child who's preoccupied with death. No, that's not right. He is preoccupied. He's afraid to start school. But he goes around and asks all the adults in his life what they're scared of. And they're scared of all different things. And they tell him, you know, somebody's scared of death. His mother is scared that something could happen to him. And to me, it was fascinating because I feel like in Europe, there might be a little more sort of tolerance for these books that just don't really have a happy ending, you know? I mean, what's comforting about this book really is that he's scared of things and he finds out that adults are too. And sometimes that is actually comforting to children to find out that, you know, it's not just that you're weird and worried about something, it's that everybody has different things that they're worried about. I mean, different publishers, I think, have a different tolerance level for, you know, how much kind of ambiguity they want in a picture book. With the Infinity story, actually, a lot of editors were interested, but a lot of publishers were like, I don't think we're going to take this on. So that was interesting, because then it sort of showed me, oh, you know, so how often is this happening that actually editors do want to do something, but, you know, for whatever reason, people think it just isn't going to sell well.
Unfortunately, that ends up being the bottom line, because publishers are mostly not nonprofit organizations.
Right.
The passion of an editor is not always, although is sometimes the driver,
right,
for whether a book gets published or
right.
not. So just as a last question, I wanted to ask you whether you have any advice you want to give to people who might be wanting to write a children's book or try to get a children's book published. What can you leave them with?
Well, I mean, with Big Bouffant, I think I wrote an early draft of the story. I showed it to someone who I believe was not even a writer, but she'd seen a bunch of my work, and I said, what do you think? She said, pretty sure it's the worst thing you've ever written. And immediately I believed her. I thought, you know, she's right. I will never show that to anyone again. And then a few years went by, and I thought, well, okay, so maybe this version of it wasn't great, but the idea, I think, is funny. And then I, you know, tried again, and, you know, like, I was right. There was something there, and that particular incarnation of it hadn't been right, but, like, I needed to hold on to the fact that I did sort of have my finger on the pulse when it came to what was funny. And so it sounds corny, but you have to plug away, and you have to believe in yourself. You have to be open to feedback, but not so open that you believe someone when they tell you that your idea is awful. I mean, some ideas are awful, but often they're maybe responding to the structure of the story more than the idea. And I think it's like anything. If you can just put aside time to do it every day, you will get better. You just can't help but improve. So people who can create that kind of discipline in their lives, it will pay off.
Well, I'm glad you didn't listen to that friend and you followed your heart instead. And I wish you all the luck in the world and much success with these books and your next book.
Thank you, Liz.